Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the CureHammer Talk Show. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at CureTalk, and along with the CureTalk team of Sharib Khan and Chintan Patel, I welcome all of you this evening for a discussion on how to eat healthy with cancer. As always, we will be moderating the call and bringing people live on the show. As most people here know, Cure Panel Talk Show is organized by CureTalk, the blog of TrialX.com, an online platform to connect patients to clinical trials of new treatments. For information on clinical trials for all conditions, please visit TrialX.com/ask. This is the 14th episode of Cure Panel Talk Show, and we are excited to announce that our broadcasts have been replayed over 49,000 times. We have quite a few interesting shows lined up for the month of June. Next week, we'll see us discussing nanotechnology in oncology with Deputy Director of Nanotechnology Characterization Lab of NCI and Yoga for Trauma with David Emerson from Justice Resource Institute. The monthly panel discussion on multiple myeloma will feature Major League Baseball coach Don Baylor and eminent myeloma expert Dr. James Berenson from Institute of Myeloma and Bone Cancer Research. Our live on-air myeloma support group meeting will be conducted on June 27th. Coming back to today's show, we are discussing how to eat healthy with cancer. Today's show has been selected by Blog Talk Radio to be featured in the staff pick section. Before we begin, I would like to mention that towards the end of the discussion, we will be taking questions from callers. They can let us know by pressing 1 on their keypads, and we will bring them online live. It is with great pleasure that I welcome Mantas Khanna to the show. Mantas is a cancer survivor and co-creator of PS It's Healthy, a website that is all about food, healthy food, and enjoying food. Hi, Mantas. I understand.
Hi, Priya.
Hi, Mantas. Welcome to the show, Mantas.
Thanks, Priya. You can hear me clearly?
Yeah, I can hear you, Mantas. Mantas, I understand that you were diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma a couple of years ago, and now you're in remission. Please share with us your journey with food and your cancer diagnosis.
Sure, I'm happy to do that. First of all, thank you for having me on the show. Thank you to the CureTalk team for inviting me. I'm certainly not a doctor or a nutritionist. I'm pretty much, as you mentioned, I'm a self-taught, healthy eating slash foodie person who is also a cancer survivor. And I blog about it now on my site, psitshealthy.com, as you mentioned. And it's really just more of a passion than anything else, because I'm now very passionate about what I eat, what I put into my body, and I'm happy to have this opportunity to share that with everybody. So why don't I start out with actually telling you a little bit about my story and my journey. I think that will help everyone just understand where I'm coming from. As Priya mentioned, I was actually more than 2 years ago, I got married and had a really amazing wedding. I'm originally from India, so my family, my husband's family, everyone is back home there. We had a great wedding. We went off for our honeymoon, and on the way back from our honeymoon, I had a funny sensation on the left side of my chest, which turned into a pretty bad pain eventually. Flying back from the honeymoon, coming back home to New York, which is where we live, the pain got really, really bad, so much so that with every breath, the pain increased. So by the time we reached home in New York, my dear new husband actually very prudently said, why don't we go to the doctor, get this checked, it's really bad. And we did. We went over to the hospital, and they did, you know, a plethora of tests, as everyone on the show probably knows, everything from blood tests to x-rays to CAT scans and PET scans, and I was diagnosed then with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. It was in stage 2, almost stage 3, so I was very lucky for it to be diagnosed at that stage because it hadn't fully spread into my body. And for those of you who don't know, lymphoma is a type of blood cancer. It's primarily in the lymphatic system. So anyway, once I was diagnosed, you know, it came as a big shock. I was very young. I still consider myself fairly young. And no one in my family had previously been diagnosed with cancer, so it was a very big shock for my family as well. I had my family here. They flew down to New York to take care of me. And then started the journey of the 6 months of chemotherapy that I went through. And as most of you are aware, that's not an easy journey. It's often very confusing. It comes with a lot of side effects, physically as well as emotionally and mentally. And one of the side effects, though, that I think really stayed with me in that it was really stuck in my head was the fact that I lost my sense of taste. And as I described to you before, I'm a huge foodie. I used to love cooking even before. I actually really enjoyed experimenting with food. It was something I was very proud of. So to lose my sense of taste was a big change for me and a big shake-up for me. And luckily for me, as I completed my 6 months of chemotherapy, the sense of taste slowly came back. But as it came back, I grew to realize that, you know, I can't eat the way that I used to eat before. I can't cook the way that I used to cook before. I really need to change my lifestyle in that aspect. And we started, my husband and I and my family started doing a lot of research in this field, just looking at nutrition and looking at nutrition as it pertains to cancer and cancer survival. And that's what I'm really here to share with you guys today. And I basically started cooking differently. I started using ingredients that I had never explored before. I started using techniques that I hadn't used before. And I believe now with all the research that we've done and the experimentation that we've done, trying raw food and vegan food, et cetera, that we've come to believe that there's this personal formula for your personal health and your nutrition that can be balanced. It doesn't have to be extreme. And that's really what the recipes on the site reflect. For me, it's my personal formula. I don't know if it fits for everybody, but I believe that there are some general guidelines that, you know, I follow that I think others can follow too. So talking about those general guidelines, I usually break them up into three parts. The first is really the things that I completely stopped eating. The second are things that I eat much more of. And the third are things that I eat in very controlled amounts now. So why don't I go through each one of those with you? The first being the things that I completely stopped eating. Now, these are things that I categorize. The disclaimer I'd love to give is that these are things that I've learned so much negative stuff about that whether or not there's concrete proof, there will always be debate about these things. But I believe that I know enough negative stuff about it that I'm just not going to take the risk and eat them. So the first and foremost thing on this list for me is actually red meats and meats in general, and especially if they're charred or barbecued or burnt in any form, I completely stay away from those. But the major reasons why I stay away from red meats are I've found that they are often injected with all sorts of hormones, especially with the recombinant bovine growth hormone or BGH, which is what it is commonly known as in the market. And usually that is given to beef. So if you're a steak lover, etc., which I used to be, now that's no longer an option for me. And it's given to beef to increase their milk production. So that is one big reason why I'm staying away from red meats. The other reason is just the casein, which is essentially the animal protein. I've read a lot about studies, including the China study and other studies outside of that, that have shown that increased consumption of casein actually increases your risk of cancer and also your other chronic diseases, like heart diseases, diabetes, etc. The third reason is what is normally called, by doctors at least, it's called the bowel transit time. And this is an interesting concept because I don't think I actually thought about food like this before, but it's actually looking at the time that it takes for your food to pass through from your mouth to the time that you release it out of your body. And if you look at meat, by and large, meat takes roughly 2 to 3 times more time to break down into your body, in your body and pass through your body. And while it's doing that, it's actually releasing a bunch of toxins which don't necessarily need to be in your blood. For example, it could be those hormones that you've ingested. And vegetables do not take that long. You know, they have a ton of fiber in them, and they essentially go through your body a lot faster. It's good in a way because it also just takes away the nutrients from the food a lot faster, and it gets absorbed into your blood faster. The fourth and last reason I stay away from red meats is essentially for the animal fat. I don't think I need any more fat on my body in general, but even then, animal fat has been long proven to be related to high levels of cholesterol, heart diseases. Studies have shown that it's actually got a very strong relationship with cancer, especially with cancers like ovarian and breast cancer, colorectal cancer. So those are all things that I don't think I want in my body, and I for that very reason, I stay away from it. So red meats and meats in general are one category. The second big category is processed foods. And by the foods here, I mean, you know, wheats and breads and sugars, because I find that they compromise the body's structure and the function of the body, and therefore are related to the development of several conditions, especially like skin conditions, pulmonary conditions, psychobehavioral conditions, and cancer. And that's for several different reasons. You'll often find that processed foods have coloring agents in them. So if you turn the bottle around and that would be, and you read the label, which by the way is one of the best habits that you can form when you're trying to become aware about what you're eating and putting into your system, you'll find that it often has a bunch of coloring agents in it, like the FDNSC Yellow 5 or the Blue 2, which are things I used to never pay attention to before, but now I do. There's also usually preservatives in it to increase the shelf life of the products, and that could be anywhere from your BHAs, your BHTs, sulfites, which have been shown to have several really adversary effects on children. Processed foods generally contain pesticides, so you'll find all sorts of organophosphates or chlorides in them. And they also have high amounts of trans fatty acids, which we all know is now a very hot topic that's being talked about. But essentially, trans fatty acids are terrible for you because although they may increase the shelf life of products and make liquid fats into like softer, hardened fats, which is great for the industry to use, your body actually can't differentiate between natural fats and trans fatty acids. And therefore, it gets deposited in things like your heart and clogs and increases your LDL, which is the bad cholesterol, or increases your chance of cancer, especially breast cancer. Another huge thing with processed foods is processed sugar. And this has been a really hard one for me in particular to stay away from because I love baking and I love desserts and, you know, as most women do, I love chocolates. So I've had to really experiment and find my way around this. But in the processed sugar category, aspartame is one of the worst things that you could potentially be eating. It increases the level of your formaldehydes. It increases the level of methanols in your body, which is extremely toxic. Even simple things like refined sugar or table sugar, the confectioner's sugar that we use in baking, are actually really bad for you. And I've spoken to a lot of nutritionists about this because it was really hard for me to cut this down, but the one thing that I constantly heard was, if you are a cancer survivor or you are someone that's going through cancer, stay away from sugars in general, but stay away from refined sugars much, much more. Like, do not even go close to them. So now in my kitchen, I don't keep anything, any refined foods, but definitely no refined sugars, no white sugar, no table sugar at all. I keep things like agave, I keep things like maple syrup. They're all raw, they're all unprocessed. And the major reason behind sugar that I found is that it gives you that glycemic spike, which you really do not want in your blood. And especially the more refined that it is, the faster it breaks down and gives you that spike. And cancer cells love that sugary, acidic environment in which that they can flourish. So definitely trying to stay away from that. The last bit within the processed foods category is canned foods. And again, this is a very hot topic. We're all hearing about this. But BPA, or the bisphenol A chemical, which is what BPA is what it's commonly known as. There are many studies that are done. One which was very shocking for me to read was that there almost 92% of canned products, have BPA in them. And BPA has been shown to be linked to all sorts of reproductive problems, all sorts of organ failure problems, especially reproductive organs. So that's another big category of foods that I stay from. I don't buy any more canned beans, no more canned tomatoes, nothing. Like, it's all gone. So those are, I think, the two big categories of foods that I've found that I stay away from. So it's generally the red meats and processed foods. the things that I do eat a lot more of, and again, this is new to me. I never used to think so much about this, but the number one thing that I eat a lot more of is organic vegetables, especially if they are green vegetables. Vegetables that have any form of chlorophyll in them are very high in phytonutrients, and I have now grown to love them. I have to admit that it wasn't very easy initially, but after knowing how good they are for you because they make your blood alkaline, which reduces the chance for cancer cells to divide or to even start out and mutate, I can't stay away from them anymore. I love my vegetables. I try to make them in all forms, but my favorite form is in green juices. What I found, actually, is that with organic vegetables, they tend to be just better tasting. They may be smaller in size, and they may not last that long, but that forces me to eat them when they're much more fresher. And I've really grown to love that. They don't have any pesticides. They don't have any fertilizers. Obviously, they're not, you know, genetically modified, which is all in the definition of being organic, but as a general category, that has probably taken over my normal meal or the proportion of the food in my normal meal a lot more. The second thing that I eat a lot more of is whole grains, seeds, and beans. Again, all organic, and that's just a general rule. Within the grains category, I eat a little less wheat, but I do still eat wheat. I'm not allergic to it, so I'm okay to still eat that. But I do eat a lot more oats. I try to diversify my grains as much as possible, and I've introduced new grains like quinoa and barley and amaranth and millet and farro. There are a ton of things that are available out there, and it's been really wonderful experimenting with all of them. They all have their own unique taste and texture. Within seeds, there's chia and flax and sunflower, but I usually really enjoy sprouting my seeds, and I eat those in the morning as breakfast. And within the beans category, there's the soybeans and mung beans, which I really enjoy eating. I think being Indian, the benefit for me at least was that usually at least the way my family has brought me up has been with a lot of grains and beans, especially the dals or lentils that I've grown up with. So it hasn't been that much of a change, and I feel like I've been able to actually experiment a lot with it. But I'm glad to kind of hold on to that heritage and tradition and build on it. The last category of things that I eat more of are herbs and teas, actually, and specifically a few herbs. So there's one herb called ashwagandha, which is actually an Ayurvedic herb, and that is shown to have great curative properties, especially for cancer sufferers. There's a root called turmeric, which has an active ingredient called curcumin, and that has recently come out in a lot of publications and scientific publications about its great anti-cancer properties. It helps cancer at every stage. So I actually have turmeric with, you know, half a glass of water or with half a glass of almond milk in the morning, or I take a pill of turmeric if I know it's from a good, reputable source. And I actually took a lot of turmeric even while I was going through chemotherapy, and I found that it really helped me. Another herb that I have a lot of is tulsi, which is an Indian herb again. It's actually known as the holy basil. Tulsi and another tree called neem, which is an evergreen tree, and you find neem products now all over the market. But if you can get these two in their unadulterated forms, they're actually amazing for your blood. They're great blood cleansers. So I try to bake that into my everyday eating. I drink a lot of green tea. It's antioxidative, so it's great for that. And another chemical, well, not a chemical, but a compound called astaxanthin, which is interestingly found in, it's a pigment that's found in the skin of, like, salmon, which gives it the pinkish color, as well as in shellfish. For example, if you're cooking prawns or crabs or lobsters, you'll find this pinkish color that comes in. That comes from astaxanthin, and that's shown to be an extremely potent antioxidant. And all of this information, by the way, I've, you know, learned over the last few years, but I've also met nutritionists of all kinds and types who will tell you all sorts of things. But I found that once I did my research, once I got the initial information and I got good quality sources of these products, that I felt comfortable taking them. So that's from mostly the things that I've eaten a lot more of. And then the final category of the things that I feel I've eat in controlled amounts are, I still eat fish and I still have some dairy. I'm very careful about the kind of dairy that I have, so it's only organic. I make sure that it has no RBH in it. For fish, I only eat wild-caught fish. It's usually cooked. I stay away from any sashimi or sushi, and I try to have the categories of fish that I know are very low in mercury. So, you know, if it's the Alaskan salmon or a halibut and other fish like that. Fruits, I eat in controlled amounts because they do give you a spike in sugar, even though it isn't as potent as, like, a refined sugar. But I try to eat fruits between meals and not right after meals, just to keep the glycemic in, you know, spikes in check. And then any forms of sugar, because I still love my chocolates and I love my baking, if I'm eating that, I'm eating it in very controlled amounts and I'm making sure that it's only natural, raw, and unprocessed. But let me actually stop there and pause there for any questions. But if I was to wrap up, I think I would just say that, you know, again, this is my personal formula and what I found to suit me, my body, and also my family follows the same sort of guidelines now. We find that we're a lot healthier in terms of having more energy. For me, luckily, I'm still in my second year of remission. You know, we just find our digestion is a lot better. We are more energetic a little bit more. We feel a lot healthful. We've lost weight. There's so many different benefits of going on this type of a diet, which is, you know, balanced in its own way. But at the end of the day, for people who, you know, who are currently going through cancer and who are coming out of cancer, for people like me, I think there are two philosophies that I found that work best for me. One has been what I put into my body, which is the food that I eat, and the other one has been what I put into my mind. And that essentially is your positive thinking, your positive spirit, surrounding yourself with positive energy and always, you know, being in that frame of mind that will allow you to heal and allow you to cure yourself through the things that you're eating and you're absorbing in your environment. So, yeah, that's literally the mantra that I live by now. But I'll stop
thank
there,
you,
Priya, and I'll let you take over.
Yeah, thank you so much. That was very comprehensive, I think. I'd like to introduce the panel. On the panel, we have noted myeloma author and survivor Pat Killingsworth with us. Welcome, Pat. Pat regularly writes about diet and cancer on his blog. Pat, what has been your experience with food and diet? Pat, you're on air. Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you clear, Pat.
Great. I was actually a vegetarian for about 11 years before I was diagnosed. But again, these things just help, right? They're no guarantees. But I find the
Pat?
Yes.
Pat, you're on air.
Is this better?
Yeah, it's
I'm here.
Yeah, I can hear you, Pat.
Okay. I have tried to improve my nutrition over the years. Your speaker is very impressive. You know what I've found, if you took a continuum, if a one is somebody who lives at McDonald's and or Burger King and considers ketchup a vegetable, and 10 is someone who eats a raw diet, or someone who thinks that nutrition can actually cure cancer as an extreme. It sounds like your gracious speaker is probably about a 7.5 or an 8. Very, you know, these are all achievable things. Of course, most people would think I could never do that much. So I'm sure she would recommend baby steps or incremental steps in trying to get there. I guess I just don't think, and my bone marrow cancer, so we both have blood cancer, I just don't think that nutrition is powerful enough to overcome resistant chemotherapy-resistant multiple myeloma, which is what I have, the bone marrow cancer that I have, I think it can help keep your body stronger. Actually, my goal is to keep my body strong enough to endure the chemotherapy that I have to take to stop the cancer. And so I guess my point is I try to eat a wide variety of food. For example, I wasn't aware of the canned food issue, but I'll try to eat a wide variety of food so I never eat enough of anything that it would potentially be harmful. And I try to eat as much, I think I eat 10 or 12 servings of fruit and vegetables a day. I like, rather than juicing, I actually puree my vegetables, make a smoothie right out of the vegetables. So I don't know. I'm probably not an 8 on that spectrum. I suppose I'm more like a 6 or a 7. I've got a long way to go. But this is some very worthwhile suggestions. I'm very impressed.
Our next panelist is Nancy Shamana, who is a myeloma survivor and columnist with Myeloma Beacon. Nancy, welcome to the show. How has been your experience with diet and cancer?
Oh, hello, Priya.
Hi, Nancy.
Hi, I hope you
Nancy.
Can hear me well. I appreciate you and probably Pat inviting me on the show. And I enjoyed hearing your talk montage. I think all you're saying is, as far as diet goes, sounds very sensible. I looked at your website. It's just beautiful. You have such nice recipes, very healthy vegetarian style, just perfect for summer. Having also had my multiple myeloma, as Pat has, I did go through quite a journey with, when I started thinking back on it, you know, the diet problems I had were quite a bit. Firstly, I had terrible bone damage and fractures, and although I was fortunate not to have increase of calcium in my blood due to dissolving of bones, nevertheless, my bones were very weak, so I do try to, you know, get in enough calcium and vitamin D to improve my bones, and I've also taken medication for that. So that's a concern that I have as a myeloma patient. Also, I went through chemotherapy, a stem cell transplant, and then more chemotherapy. All of that was pretty tough on my digestive system. I went through periods of nausea, and then at the same time I was taking a compound, it's a steroid called dexamethasone, and it can cause you to have an increase of appetite. So, you know, combining the fact that I was injured and not as active as I used to be, and also having this dex that increased my appetite, that was a difficult to maintain a healthy weight. Then through the stem cell transplant, the very high-dose chemotherapy I took called melphalan, was hard on my digestive tract, and I had a hard time with most food at that time. I had a strange sense of smell, and my taste was off. Well, I got through all of that, and now I'm out the other side of it, thank goodness. So now I'm just trying to eat healthy. And I find your suggestions are similar to what we eat at home. My husband, Dilip, also grew up in India, and so we eat lots of dal, sambar, lentils, whole grain. I'm into the organic veggies. I like organic milk. I'm Canadian. I like maple syrup. And it all sounds good. I don't bake that much anymore either. So maybe I should leave it at that for now.
Thank you, Nancy. We have one more panelist today with us, but I think we just lost her call. She's Smriti Parikh, nutritionist and dietitian at nutritionrank.com, and she just called in from India. It's like around 4 o'clock in the morning. I think once we get her back, maybe she would give her take on the topic. Pat, can you please continue with your question for Mantas?
Yes, I guess my question is, what are your feelings about curative, I mentioned it once before, about the curative value of nutrition. I always become concerned when someone says, well, I'm going to do the Gerson protocol and use enemas and wheatgrass and do nothing but eat nothing but a raw diet, and that's going to cure my cancer. How do you look at that?
Sure. Can you hear me, Pat?
I can.
Andrea? Okay, great. So again, Pat, I have to say I'm not a nutritionist or a doctor, so I'm putting the disclaimer out there. But from my own personal beliefs and the research that I've done, I don't think that going an extreme way, it all depends, I guess, on, you know, what stage you're at. If you are late stage 4 and you're really looking, you've looked at all sort of allopathic treatments, the traditional Western treatments, and you don't find that any of those are going to do anything for you, then I know some people who have gone into Ayurveda in a big way, have gone into the Gerson Institute in a big way, have gone to the Hippocrates Institute in Florida in a big way, and decided that that's the way they're going to cure themselves. Now, you know, you only hear about the success stories. I don't know how many of those are unsuccessful. But personally, if it was me in that stage, I think I would do both. So I do believe that there are some herbs and some things that you can take that are curative, and turmeric happens to be one of them. Ashwagandha tends to be is one of them. Astaxanthin tends to be one of them. I would just take those to help in whatever way, you know, the chemotherapy, radiation, transplants that I'm doing would help me. Now, as long as none of those clash with any one of those treatments, it's okay. So I would be mindful of that. But from what I know, at least when I was going through chemotherapy, I was allowed to take everything that I wanted, including things like green tea or astaxanthin. I was having a lot of turmeric. I would drink a shot of wheatgrass juice every morning whenever I could take it, because I was also nauseous and I actually don't like wheatgrass juice at all, but it's grown on me now. But I feel like those are fine as supplementary to whatever treatment that you're doing. I'm not sure if I would only rely on that to cure me, unless there was absolutely no other way for me.
I think that's a great answer. One of the challenges that myeloma patients face is having to take so much dexamethasone, which is like prednisone squared, or I kid that it's prednisone on steroids. It's about 5 times more powerful than prednisone.
Yeah.
And you don't just take it for the 6 months. You basically take it on and off for the rest of your life. And I've had issues. For one problem with dexamethasone is it heightens those spikes in blood sugar. And another issue is it breaks your muscle mass down.
Hmm.
And the combination of, this cancer attacking your bone marrow and losing muscle mass through the therapy that you take, I think it's very difficult to go on an all-vegetarian diet. I mean, I know you can get enough protein in an all-vegetarian diet for a normal person, but you're really fighting a battle on several fronts here. And I even went to a nutritionist, one of these holistic nutritionists, and you could just see her face contort as she recommended that I eat grass-fed bison 3 times a week and organic calf's liver and a couple other things, and you could just see it was so painful for her. But her thinking was, you're trying to, you know, we're trying to get those blood counts up because you're just anemic and neutropenic and all of these things. And then, of course, for me, the problem is I just keep losing muscle mass, and like with a lot of cancers, I guess, you become thinner and thinner, and it's not just that you're not fat, it's that there isn't as much muscle there. Any thoughts on that?
So I think there are two ways to look at it, right? I mean, you can get your proteins from your vegetables and especially from grains and the quinoas and things like that. That's one way to do it. But if that's not enough and you are unusually losing your muscle mass, then maybe another way to look at it is that you look at the quality of the meat that you're eating, if you do need to eat meat to get that extra protein, right? So
yeah,
quantity is one, but quality. So if you focus on, getting that absolutely no hormone, the grass-fed. But even when it's grass-fed, you want to check, okay, it might be grass-fed, but what kind of grass is it that they're eating? Where exactly is this farm located? Are they still being injected with hormones? If they're eating just, are they eating really just grass, or are they eating some kind of a feed, and is that feed genetically modified? And getting access to that information, I think, is the biggest obstacle for all of us, right? Because it's not readily available. There aren't rules and regulations about disclosure of that stuff. So I feel like that's the most frustrating part for me, that if I'm not able to get that information, then I might as well cut that out. Now, of course, I'm lucky enough to not be on chemotherapy right now, so, you know, my heart goes out to what you're going through. But what I would say is just be as strict as possible with the quality of the meat that you're eating if you do need to eat the meat. And eat the meat that is a little easier to break down. So out of the red meats, if it's the white meats like the turkey and chicken, which also has all those amino acids that are, you know, readily bioavailable for your body to absorb, don't go for the beef and don't go for the bison maybe. That's my initial advice.
I think that's just wonderful advice. I just want to say, Nancy. Nancy is comments on my blogs a lot, and I love the Canadian accent. Made my day. She writes just like she talks. It's nice to meet you on the phone, Nancy.
Yeah, thanks, Pat. That's so nice. I was looking forward to chatting on this program also, and we'll have to chat again sometime too. I just wanted to make a little comment about the antioxidants. When I was taking Velcade, which is a drug specific for multiple myeloma patients, I'm not sure that you would have had it, Montaz, but we were specifically warned not to take in any green tea or vitamin C, you know, supplements, nothing like that, any antioxidants whatsoever, and I sure didn't. I didn't even take a vitamin pill.
That's right, and I think I think that's sound advice, and you should definitely listen to that, because the chemicals that are going into your body can often be in conflict with antioxidants that you take, especially while you're going through chemotherapy or on any particular medication. So I think that's great. What I would say, though, Nancy, is that now that you're out of it, you're off the medication, which you are. Am I assuming that correctly?
Yes.
Okay.
So
now that you are on the other side, as you put it, congratulations, by the way. These would be things to start putting into your diet, and if you could introduce things like turmeric, which I'm sure Dilip knows about. Not just in your cooking, but if you can even have it a little raw, which is the best way to have it, and you get it in a Whole Foods market or in your local farmer's market or even grow it at home, that has, you know, such potent anti-cancer effects. It's great for you. And the other things that I talked about, like astaxanthin, the green tea, tulsi, neem, those are all great, powerful blood cleansers for you to take on a regular basis. It's what I take now on a preventative basis, essentially.
I'm certainly trying to eat healthy. With blueberries are a fruit that is grown right near me here, and these sorts of things, I'm trying to incorporate that into my diet more.
So actually, I know the blueberries have such a huge hullabaloo about them being so high in antioxidants, and yes, they are, but everything is always on a relative scale. So if you actually look into research, blueberries are on a moderate scale, high in antioxidants, but there are these other things that I spoke to you about, like the astaxanthin, green tea, ashwagandha, these are all much, much higher in the antioxidant levels. There's actually a great study which quantifies the amount of antioxidants in the foods that we eat, and there's a specific Mediterranean spice, actually, that has a very high level of antioxidants, and I'd be happy to share that with you. And Nancy, you said you've been on the site, so if you actually go to psishealthy.com, there's an infographic that we have on the site on antioxidants that describes exactly these levels of the levels of antioxidants that are found in foods.
Yes, you have a very nice website, and I'll be revisiting it. That is for sure.
Yep, and be sure to look at that antioxidant infographic in particular.
Nancy, please continue with your questions.
Sorry?
I see that you have, Nancy, I see you have a couple of more questions to ask, Manta.
Oh, yes.
Please go ahead and ask them. Yes.
So, because I started thinking about my journey. My journey with myeloma officially began, you know, about 4 years ago. That's when I realized I had it. I'm sure I had it before then, too, though. And because I went through a variety of treatments, you know, I had a variety of concerns. And, you know, I did touch on some of them. The bone damage, you know, that's a really big issue with myeloma patients. A lot of us have experienced what you could politely call osteopenia, but actually, you know, fractures and holes in our bones and all kinds of awful things. So for us, unless we should so happen to have a high level of calcium in our blood, you know, have to be trying to build up our bones. So what sort of advice do you deal with that at all?
Yeah, Nancy. So I feel like with calcium in particular, it's really tricky, right? You can try to get as much of it as possible from your diet, but if you're at a stage where, you know, it's you're neutropenic and you essentially need a lot more to build your bones, you do need to supplement it with additional supplements. And as you know, calcium is actually best absorbed and most bioavailable when it's taken with vitamin D and with magnesium. So if you're taking a supplement, make sure that that is contained in it. On a nutrition or a food side, the best sources for calcium are essentially dark leafy greens. So the kales, the collards, etc., are really good greens to be having to get calcium, and they're also very bioavailable. More bioavailable than calcium is ever in milk or dairy. And also other vegetables like broccoli, turnip, and then non-vegetable sources like sesame seeds, seaweed, almonds, tofu or soybeans, all of these are really high in calcium. And vitamin D, as you know, it's actually really tough to absorb even if you're sitting in the sun all day, depending on the time of the year. You're probably getting burnt and you're not getting as much vitamin D as you need. So it's best to take a vitamin D supplement if you're really low on that. The foods that vitamin D you can get from are, you know, good fish. Again, make sure it's wild-caught, it's low in mercury. Egg yolks are very good for vitamin D. And I try not to eat them too much, so you might need to eat them a little bit more, but for me a reasonable diet is having fish maybe 2 to 3 times a week. I have 1 or 2 eggs a week, but I try not to have more than that. Of course, again, all of this depends, you know, on your personal formula, on your blood type, what exactly you need. So, you know, be scientific about it. Go get your blood test done. Look at the reports. Go to a nutritionist with that and then decide where you are deficient and what you need to take. That's pretty much the process that I went through, and I found, like, taking even vitamin D supplements, because I was very low on it after I finished chemotherapy. And, in fact, then we became vegan, which was even worse for us. And that's when the nutritionist actually prescribed vitamin D supplements to us, which I took for about 1 to 3 months, and then started taking it less after that.
Yes, I actually do, you know, have discussed this with my family doctor, and I do take calcium tablets, which are fortified with vitamin D, and there's also vitamin D in the multivitamins that I take. Here in the northern hemisphere, there's very low likelihood of getting enough vitamin D from the sunshine. Now, Pat might be getting enough because he lives in a nice sunny place. Up here, we're not suntanning very much.
Except you're supposed to stay out of the sun, and I've had melanoma as a secondary cancer because of my compromised immune system and probably has something to do with chemotherapy drugs that I take.
Yeah, I think I went through the same thing, especially during chemo and for about a year after chemo. Actually, I was advised not to go into the sun too much, and if I was, I had to put a bunch of sunblocks on me, which themselves are known to be cancer-causing. So, you know, I wasn't getting my vitamin D from anywhere. It had to be through supplements, and it had to be through the food I was eating. But vitamin D is a very difficult one to crack.
Wouldn't it be nice if, you know, they've come out with these studies after 20 and 30 years where taking selenium and vitamin E didn't help, you know, with prostate cancer or any of these things. But Wouldn't it be nice? Now, you have lymphoma, correct?
That's right.
Okay. Wouldn't it be great to take a group of patients, even if it was only 30 or 40 or 50, and follow them and have them make some drastic nutritional changes and have the other ones not, and just follow it and see. It's so unfortunate that, and of course it allows Western medicine to assault and dismiss nutrition as, you know, an unscientific science.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be interesting to do?
I think it would be wonderful. Yeah, I think it would be wonderful. I think one of the big things that I struggled with, and especially my mom and my sister struggled with while I was going through chemotherapy, was that they didn't know what to feed me. They were like, are there any good foods that I should be feeding my child? And, you know, are there any good drinks and foods in terms of, like, fruits and vegetables that she'd be eating, things she should not be eating? The only guideline I was given, as I'm sure you were all given, was just don't eat anything that, you know, may have an increased level of bacteria because you're immunocompromised. But beyond that, doctors don't really give you any other advice in terms of what to eat or what not to eat. And it would be great to be able to have that.
The other issue is how much. Curcumin, which is fabulous, I agree with you, and actually, for myeloma, it's an optimum type of thing. But, I mean, we're talking 2 grams, 4 grams, 6 grams, 8 grams or more, you know, and nobody knows. Well, it's between 2 grams and 8 grams if you're going to supplement, or, you know, so you'd like to think that eating a few blueberries or a couple egg yolks a week would make a difference, but, you know, it's hard to imagine that type of fine-tuning in your in what you eat could, except maybe in your case, where your body can become so healthy and supple and subtle in the way that it absorbs and looks at nutrients. You might actually be able to retrain your body to make the most out of what it gets. And again, though, it's just hard to prove it.
It's really hard to prove it, and you know it's hard beyond just saying the superficial effects that you feel. There isn't really any way for you to prove it or even show it to other people, let alone for a doctor to show it, right? So unless they, like you said, unless it was a multi-year study that follows people that have made a very specific directional change in their nutrition, I think it's very difficult to actually have proof. And that tends to be the biggest reason why doctors don't tell you anything about diet, right? Because there haven't been any controlled studies that have been done in laboratories that have been followed through for a certain amount of time that have been published in a peer-reviewed journal that they can refer to and say confidently. But I also know a lot of oncologists.
Curcumin has, by the way, though.
Yes, curcumin has. And I think they've been able to do that at the cell level and show that it actually has a benefit to cancer in all stages of cancer. But I also know a lot of oncologists, as I was saying, that, you know, on the side, as your friend or as your family friend, would give you this advice and say, look, just, we know that there are all these things out there that have shown some kind of at least superficial benefit. They might not be published articles on the benefits of them, but just do it because you never know, it actually has a really good effect on you and it could even help you. And because they are natural and because they, you know, don't have side effects, there is no harm in taking them. Now, your question of how much to take, that's one that still needs to be cracked or answered. I don't think that there is no one golden silver bullet or whatever you want to call it for that.
I think we have Smriti back online. We managed to get Smriti. Smriti is actually a nutritionist and dietitian with nutritionrank.com. We lost you there, Smriti. Please add your input to the topic.
Yeah.
Smriti, can you hear me? Yeah, Smriti, you're on air.
Yes, loud and clear. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Yes, I can. Please go ahead.
You can. Great. So, first, I'd like to thank you for this opportunity. And it was such a graspable talk, and I just loved hearing all of them, Nantaz, Pat, Nancy, everyone. So it was a great talk. And what we are trying to do at NutritionRank.com is make nutrition a little more simpler for people. we rank fourth from 0 to 100 being the healthiest ones. So it's easier for the common man to pick up saying, okay, not everybody. This is healthy for you. So that's what we are trying to do. And Matt has his talk and her site really, really helps him. So I did have a few questions for her. One was I wanted her opinion on fluid intake and how basically she optimized it, because some people require more fluid and some people have to retain the, restrict their fluid intake. So I would love to know what she has to say about it.
So, Smriti, that's a very personal question, actually. And it really, like you said, it really completely depends on the person's metabolism, right? Because, as you said, there are some people that tend to retain more fluid, depending on some condition that they may have, whereas others tend to lose it a lot quicker. So, did you want to know about fluid intake as it pertains to someone that's undergoing cancer? Cancer treatment, or was it in general?
It was during cancer treatment. Basically, I needed your thoughts on how do I add to the fluids. I mean, what did you feel was acceptable?
So the number one fluid basically is water. There's no question about that. And especially while going through chemotherapy,
definitely,
I was advised to drink tons and tons of water. I was having maybe twice the amount of water that I used to have before, and anyway, I was not a great drinker, so it was a really good thing for me. But it's really important that you flush out as much of the toxins and the chemicals that are going into your body with an increased amount of water. So that was number one. The number two thing that I added in terms of fluid intake to myself was juices, and I did much more of vegetable and fruit juices while I was going through chemotherapy. Again, tending more towards vegetable than fruits. And even with fruits, you want to be careful about which fruits. You don't want to have overly sweet fruits that, you know, spike up your glycemic index again. So one of the big juices that I had almost every second day was actually what we call ABC, or apple, beet, and carrot, which is great for building your red blood count cell. I had a lot of green juices. And again, every juice while you're going through chemotherapy has to be thoroughly washed, because, you know, it can have some bacteria on it, and you want to be really careful about that. So in general, my fluid intake went up a lot more. The things that you want to stay away from if you're having juices and they're not fresh are, you know, the store-bought juices that have, like, sugar, high fructose corn syrup. Hello? Hello?
Yes, Santos, go ahead. Yeah.
Sorry. So you want to stay away from juices that are shelf-bought, that may have high fructose corn syrup in them, may have juice concentrates in them. You just don't know where that's coming from, or, you know, even have any kind of preservatives in them. I've definitely switched to much more of the fruit juices side of things. So that's pretty much it in terms of fluid intake. In terms of controlling things which could prevent your fluid intake from actually going up are things like caffeine and alcohol, which you already probably know. They dehydrate you, and, you know, I obviously wasn't having any of that while I was undergoing treatment. And even now, actually, I've cut it down quite a bit.
Thank you, Mantaz. Is there time for, like, another question?
Yes, Smriti, please go ahead. We have a couple of minutes more.
Sure. So I would love to know how you tackled lack of appetite. You did talk quite clearly and about your loss of taste and how you conquered it. But lack of appetite is something I'd love to hear about, because, I mean, first-hand information is always great.
Sure. So that's a really, really tough one. As I mentioned, I lost my sense of taste. So I could taste a few things, like I could taste some sweet things. Even then, it tasted really strange, and I'm sure Pat and Nancy can back me up on this, but you do either get strange tastes or you lose your taste. Also, eggs, surprisingly, were the only thing that I could taste, so, you know, I would crave for eggs. I am a huge foodie, so I would get up in the middle of the night craving like this one dish that I love to have in Singapore, which is a spicy noodle. And, you know, even if I got up and I made it, I couldn't taste it. So that was very frustrating. So I think the first thing you need to deal with when you're dealing with like loss of appetite is this psychological and this emotional connect, which just makes you not want to eat more, even though you can't taste it and you know you need to eat. You just don't want to because you can't taste it. And there's such a huge emotional connection, which was a very big revelation for me. I actually didn't know that because I'd never experienced something like that before. So I would say, you know, deal with that. You're a nutritionist, Smriti, so I don't know if you're dealing with patients who actually have cancer and are suffering from loss of appetite. But give them things that are easier for them to eat. They could be things like soups, juices, just like mashed things or, you know, blended things, which make it easier to also swallow, because along with loss of appetite, it's usually also difficulty in swallowing that you have. And that, you know, any kind of liquid form of food is easier to do. If there are certain foods that the patient really can still kind of taste and enjoys the taste of, sometimes there's no harm in actually giving them a little bit more of that just so that it encourages them to be a little bit more positive about what they're eating. For example, if there were days where I would refuse to eat anything, but I could taste eggs, I would at least have an egg or two and I would feel better that, look, you know, I can still taste a little bit. I'm still feeling positive and I have a more positive outlook about, you know, just my condition and how I will be, and the fact that I can taste is good. And so just giving that hope of it will come back, I think, is essential. And then, yeah, I generally think like loss of appetite is probably the biggest thing. At least for me, it was a really big thing. It was bigger than losing my hair. It was bigger than just losing my, you know, my energy. But it eventually comes back, and I think that positive spirit and positive thinking is really important when it comes to that.
Thank you, Mantas. I think we can take a couple of questions from listeners. Callers, please press 1 on your keypads if you have a question for our panel. Callers may press 1 on the keypads and we'll bring you live to ask your question to the panel. Mantas, I think we have just a couple of minutes. Maybe you could share one of your recipes with us which would be good for cancer survivors and those undergoing treatment too.
Sure.
Oh, yes. Before that, Mantas,
we have a question.
I think
okay.
We have a caller. Yes. A person calling in from 860798. Please ask your question.
I'm just wondering about juicing, and if you have low white blood count and you can't eat fresh fruit because of the risk of being exposed to bacteria and infection, what other options do you have?
So that's actually a great question. It was one that I struggled with a lot. I'm sure Pat and Nancy can give their inputs on this too. I found that when I was juicing, I was having limited juices, so only juices that I knew were really important for me to have. So I mentioned the apple, beet, and carrot. They were all washed thoroughly for me in really hot water. And, you know, with gloves so that no human infection was passed on. I did have very low white blood count cells, and I was still having the juice, and I felt like it really helped me because it gave me a little extra boost of energy. It also helped my red blood count cell to go up a little bit. So juices were, you know, in limited amounts, and being particular about what you're having is, I think, fine. You want to just make sure that they're really sanitized and washed very well. If you can't have juices, then, you know, you can always do soups, which are cooked. You can cook actually a carrot and do a juice out of that, like puree it and have that. There are many options if you only want to go with cooked food.
Yes, Pat, what's your take on this?
Yes, well, first of all, I think that's a mistake. Just because your white counts are low, to stop eating the very nutrition that can help your counts possibly rebound and help you feel better and be healthier and fight off colds and infections. So I guess other than go to a salad bar or something, I don't see anything wrong with juicing. I mean, I think I was juicing within 6 weeks after undergoing a stem cell transplant. And, I just, when in doubt, I opt for the healthy food, not opt to take it out of my diet. but I'm not a physician.
Nancy, what?
Yeah, I just
Nancy, what do you think?
When I had very low immunity, I had to be careful about things like, you know, salad bars and things like that. You have to avoid that. And also fruits like raspberries and blackberries and strawberries that have little pits on the surface and are harder to clean. So I avoided those sorts of things. But other than that, I had apple juice and orange juice and mango juice. And Dilip made me some fresh juice, too.
And, of course, if you buy them commercially, unfortunately, they're pasteurized. But if you're recovering from, if you have a compromised immune system, being pasteurized is probably a good thing, but it's probably not a great thing from a nutritional standpoint.
Right. So I think to our listener, essentially, if you can, I don't think there's any harm in juicing. You should definitely go ahead and juice. Just make sure that you're being very careful about washing it really carefully. You're being choiceful about the fruits that you're having, like Nancy mentioned. But don't steer away from them. Just still have them.
Mandas, we have a minute, so maybe we can just share the recipe. Just a minute more.
Right, okay, so I'm going to do a recipe in a minute, but this is essentially, well, this might actually meet our callers, the person who asked the question. It's a green juice recipe, and it's one that I actually love to have in the morning. It's essentially an ounce of wheatgrass juice. It's a stick of celery, and by the way, you can with wheatgrass, you probably have to mill the juice. You can't actually just put it through a juicer because it requires a squeezing of the chemicals out of it. I usually juice a couple of leaves of celery with it. And what I do is I add all of this to a nice glass of coconut water, fresh organic coconut water if possible, and add maybe a teaspoon or less of turmeric, a little bit of black pepper because that makes the turmeric more bioavailable to your blood, or I add a little bit of ginger and lime to it. But this shot of, you know, coconut, which cools you down and then and gets rid of all the heat which is collected from all the chemicals in you, in addition to the green, which makes your blood alkaline, is really, really good to start your day with. And that's the recipe that I would recommend.
You know, it sounds beautiful, and whether
Thank
it works
you.
Or not, you feel like it works.
Yeah, and that's what's important.
Exactly.
Coconut.
Nancy and smoothie, yes.
Yeah,
Mantis, Pat, Nancy, Smoothie. Thank you so very much, Smoothie. We had a little bit of trouble getting you here, but thank you very much for joining us. It was great to have you all here and share your experiences with us. Your talk
thanks
all its listeners and participants. Thank you all for your support, and we look forward to having all of you join us for the next Your Panel Talk Show. For more details of our upcoming shows, please visit trilex.com/CureTalk. The link for today's broadcast will be sent to all panelists and participants and also made available on Cure Talk within 24 hours. Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Priya.
Very much. Really appreciated
this. Thank you.
Thank you, ladies.
Thank you.